Welcome to the Data Points Podcast, created by the Bloomberg Center for Government Excellence at Johns Hopkins University. We explore the ways the public sector is using data to understand complex issues, engage residents, and ultimately improve quality of life, particularly for underserved communities. My name is Evan Serpik, and I'm the Director of Communications at GovX. In this role, I help spread the word about the work that GovX does to help cities use data creatively and effectively to improve the lives of residents across the U.S. and around the globe. Today, we're celebrating Women's History Month by talking to some of the women who made history by leading the development of the Coronavirus Resource Center, or CRC. The CRC was a collaborative effort led by the Bloomberg Center for Government Excellence and the Center for System Science and Engineering at Johns Hopkins University during the COVID-19 pandemic. It was built by a team of experts with skill sets ranging from data and analytics to GIS engineering to epidemiology to sociology and many other fields. We're shedding a light on the women who led the charge behind a tool recognized for its substantial impact on our understanding of what was a rapidly developing situation, to say the least. Our guests today are Dr. Lauren Gardner, the Alton and Sandra Cleveland Professor in the Department of Civil and Systems Engineering at Johns Hopkins Whiting School of Engineering, with a joint appointment in the Bloomberg School of Public Health; Beth Blauer, the Associate Vice Provost for Public Sector Innovation at Johns Hopkins and the founder of GovX; Dr. Sarah Bertrand-DeLee, the Director of Research and Analytics at GovX; and Mary Conway Vaughn, the Deputy Director of Research and Analytics at GovX. Thank you all for being here today.
Thanks for having us.
Dr. Gardner, I want to start with you. I know this work started in January 2020, if we can think back that long, with you and your student, Encheng Dong, who is Chinese and was checking COVID data coming out of China at the time. Can you tell me a little bit about your first encounter with what your student was doing and how you thought it might be expanded on?
Yeah, sure. So thanks so much for having me on this. So Encheng goes by Frank. And yeah, I think it's important to remember the timing. So we started having conversations about this in mid-January, which was a time when there was just a few hundred cases of what wasn't even yet known as COVID-19 in just a few provinces in China. And so Frank was kind of personally interested in this, seeing as it was coming from his home country, and was basically building out a very simple daily Excel sheet with the cases that were being reported locally at the time. And during one of our meetings, when we were talking about other infectious disease threats, we started looking at this data. And of course, not knowing where it was going to go, I have a long history of working in the space of infectious disease modeling and specifically about importation and exportation of these new emerging pathogens, and know that it's a very, very data poor field, and that at the earliest stages of these new emerging viruses, data is so critical and something that usually we don't have access to. And so this was a unique opportunity to collect and share information on a situation like this that may or may not be useful at the time. We weren't really sure where this was going to go, obviously. And so we just decided to commit to following this and sharing this data. And we decided to collect the data, make it public, and build a map to go alongside it to visualize the data. And that was the start. And obviously, we knew where that went within days and weeks afterwards.
Right. So I understand it started with that initial map. And I wonder, Beth, if you can tell me about when you first encountered that initial map and your thoughts about how it could be translated for a broader audience in what would eventually become the CRC.
So I actually was scheduled to go to India on a trip for GovX. We were doing some work in Indian cities around their data capabilities. And I had been hearing anecdotally about this emerging health crisis that was coming from China. And I was trying to figure out whether or not it actually made sense to travel and to go on an international trip. And this was like at the end of February, beginning, or the end of January, beginning of February. And so as a data person, the first thing I did was start to kind of try to figure out where there was data that could help us figure out whether or not we would be taking a group from GovX over to India. And the only source of data that I could find was this kind of very nascent research-based data set that Dr. Gardner and Frank had been working on. And I saw the map and I was tracking it and I was looking at the data and reading the news and trying to understand. And then I realized, like, oh, this is really the only source of this data. And I actually reached out to Lainey Rutko and the president in the university president's office. And I was like, look, this is the only data source that exists. Like, how can I help? I work with a whole network of mayors that are going to have to make pretty critical decisions in the next few weeks, months. Is there something that we can do to do some work that would take this data and help guide some of the public policy that was going to have to be made in order to be responsive? And they were immediately like, yes, we're trying to like figure out what the next steps are. We're working with Dr. Garner. And Ron Daniels, to his credit, was like, do you know Lauren? And I said, no, I don't know Lauren. And he was like, you have to know Lauren. You have to meet Lauren. And so I basically just started stalking Lauren, and I started calling her, and like immediately her phone was like, I'm not taking calls right now. Then I emailed her and she was like, I'm not responding to emails right now. And I called like a few times, and I finally was like, I think I texted her and I was like, look, I know you're not talking to anyone, but I promise you, I won't waste your time, or something like that, to that effect. We should probably go back and like look at the what there's.
I was not that hard to get a hold of.
Oh, you were 100% that hard to get a hold of. And like even Ron was like, it's going to be hard to get her on the phone. She's busy. She's underwater on this project. And then we had like an initial conversation, and I think I was able to at least sell myself enough to Lauren to get her to agree to go on a walk with me. We lived in a close neighborhood. And so this was like when it took a while. So this was probably like mid-February. It was before campus closed. And so we went for a walk. And I'm not going to put words in Lauren's mouth, but I do think it was love at first sight. and we actually like realized that we had a lot of the same values when it came to public data, into what this resource of data would look like and how it would impact people and the kind of values that we wanted to bring into a project like this. And so I knew that there was an opportunity for us to help. And I knew more specifically that Sarah was probably the right person. And I know we're going to bring Sarah into the conversation to bring in to this trifecta to kind of help us with the translational stuff. But I knew even more that we needed to like think about organization and how we were going to actually like, I think I had a view of how big this thing was, and we needed the best project manager in the world to help us. And so I begged Mary, who will also be brought into this conversation, to join us. So I really felt more like a connector at the beginning. I was using the data for my personal use. I met Lauren. I begged Lauren to let us help her, and she graciously let us come in and help. But the idea for us initially was really, how do we put together a couple of lightweight visualizations to help sort of democratize some of the messages that were going to have to accompany the tough policy decisions that communities were going to have to make and that people were going to have to make?
Got it. And so, Sarah, if I can turn to you, I understand that Beth initially looped you in like early February, specifically to provide some data visualizations on some of those early metrics around cumulative cases and deaths and mortality rate. Can you talk a little bit about your initial approach and how you thought, you know, you would handle those requests?
Yeah, I actually was able to go back to these first initial message, and it was actually on March 19th. We were already 3 or 4 days into working remotely, so still getting used to it. And Beth shared with me the repository that Lauren was putting together and asked me, can you start thinking about how to visualize this data? So I quickly jump in and I opened the data and put together a Jupyter notebook and started to think like, what would be interesting? And you know, you immediately come up with 3 or 4 visualizations. Funny thing also, I thought like, oh, we have testing data and we have cases. What if I divide those things? So I started like, I think, playing to be an epidemiologist a little bit, which I think all of us were at that point in time. And, you know, on the same Slack thread, you could already start like feeling the chaos from the first days, because I was telling her like, yeah, I will have something for tonight. So immediately you send me something in the morning, we'll have something tonight, we are meeting tomorrow morning. And then I was asking, can you send some link? And Beth was like, I don't have a Zoom account. Can you imagine? And so those were the days. And then
yeah,
I was also
halcyon days.
Yeah, I was pulling in an analyst and she was chow. And then she was telling me already, like, I have my two kids at home and, you know, already sending memes about how you should, like, kidnap your kids if you want to work at home. So the whole thing was happening on this first Slack thread on March 19th. So very, very interesting to go back and read that.
Yeah, it's funny you say that. Mary actually showed me her Slack message, which was from Beth asking, like, do you have a little bit of capacity to help me with this little Hopkins project, you know? And Mary's like, yeah, I think I have, like, you know, a third time or something like that. You talk about what your initial plans were.
Yeah, well, the project that I'd been working on entailed travel. And as Beth indicated, the university at that point had shut down campus and had shut down travel and things along those lines. So all of that time that had been allocated to the other project, I thought, sure, I have some capacity. Why not do this? And my wheelhouse has always been project management, specifically for web development. So it felt like returning back to the cornerstone of what my career had been to date. So I thought, why not? Right place, right time, dedicate some of my coordination management abilities to this particular project. It sounds fun. I did not realize that it was more like 130% of my time and less than
for 30. 3 years.
Yeah.
I would say Mary was one of a few people or many people that got brought in under very false pretenses of we just need you for a few hours, a few each week. And then 3 years later, their entire life had been totally encompassed by this project.
Yeah, that sounds about right. Because I as Sarah was saying, and Sarah, how old was Inez at the time that you were working on these visualizations?
4 months old.
Yeah, it was like, it was her first, one of her, the first asks I made of you when you came back from your maternity leave.
Literally.
Yeah. And so there were lots of late night Zooms with Sarah, and you were still in Baltimore.
I was, yeah.
Yeah. So you were still in Baltimore. There was a baby and we got to see the baby on Zoom.
A lot.
How many? We had babies? A lot of babies. We had a lot of babies on Zoom for this project, actually, across the board.
I was going to ask, you know, in those early days of the pandemic, you know, there was so much uncertainty and everyone was adapting to new norms, worried about your personal health, your family's health. And of course, you all were doing this work that was so central to what everyone was managing. I wonder if anybody sort of can talk about how you balanced your personal concerns and, you know, your sort of home life, family life with this work you were doing.
Well, I can say that, you know, my coping mechanism for much of my life has always been when I don't want to deal with anything, I just work. And so this was like the ultimate way to escape the reality of the fact that, like, we were being confronted with so much horror, especially like how quickly COVID hit our shores and then like how devastating it was. And, you know, I think the only way that I was able to survive those days was to throw myself into the work. But it was honestly like totally, you know, not great for my kids. So I had, you know, at that time, middle school kids. One in elementary school, one in middle school. They were learning how to work from home also. And we were working on this project 12 to 15 hours a day easily. I think that there were definitely tons of sacrifices that were being made. My kids are resilient. They know how to use technology. They were getting into their classes. I don't think at the time I fully understood just like how much working from home meant that the line between home and work is like so deeply blurred. So I just, you know, my desk was in my bedroom and I basically took a break to make meals and that was it. And then it was work from the minute you woke up until the minute you went to sleep. We had a standing 9 p.m. meeting with the Hopkins team that, you know, oftentimes I would be in that meeting from 9 till 11 or 12 at night. And then we had our first like scrum like at 7:30, 8 o'clock in the morning. And so it was, and then, you know, I would occasionally get a chance to make a meal. So we established some routines. Like in our house, I would call my cousin every night at dinner time, and we would like have dinner with like family, basically, you know, on Zoom. And then we would all play Boggle on Zoom for like a half an hour after dinner. And I felt like I was nailing it, you know, but unfortunately, I think my kids might have felt differently.
Yeah, that period of time, it was, I think we refer to those 9 p.m. meetings as like slumber parties, because most people were like kind of in the middle of either putting children to bed or getting ready for whatever kind of sleep they could get. And yeah, they were weirdly intimate, right? Because you were seeing everyone's home situation. You were seeing their bedrooms. You were seeing their children run past. We know each other's pets' names, you know, things like that. And it was really immersive because we were squeezing 6 months worth of work into 6 weeks, basically. So I think that kind of intensity is not something that you necessarily, it can't sustain, especially with personal life and family life and things like that. So you can sacrifice for a period of time, but then you need to step back a little and have the routines established and things like that. That's what I tried to be helpful in is setting up some structures around which people could operate and not have to be on 20 hours a day.
Yeah. It seems like from the get-go, the tool was hugely important and useful and used by governments, you know, and universities and schools. And did you feel some kind of a pressure? I mean, was that part of what went into those crazy hours that, oh my God, this is actually really central to the you know, the people, way the world is managing this?
Well, Lauren definitely, because she was our source, right? So like none of the front end, which is what we were all working on, functioned without the work that Lauren was doing.
Yeah, it was, I think pros and cons, the structure that they're talking about with 9 p.m. meetings and 7 a.m. meetings. On the data collection side, it was just a rolling 24/7 process. So I actually didn't have any of that structure. It was because we were collecting data around the clock and it was international. So people were responding to that data and requesting things, and there was issues. It was through the night, through the morning. I mean, there was just a group on Slack engaged all the time. So totally unsustainable. But to this question that you're asking, I think that's actually what motivated and drove us, was because it was so rewarding. We saw this need, we were contributing. I think that most of the people that were on the data collection side of it, that were working these hours, probably never felt so rewarded and, you know, like they were contributing so much in their life in terms of a work project. And it really was the thing that kept everyone on board. But we had to do some pretty regular mental checks as well to kind of make sure everyone was doing okay. Because throughout the process, when you get 6 months, a year into it, especially that first year, it isn't a sustainable work schedule at all. And we were seeing real burnout, understandably, and having to kind of force people to take shifts off or back off for a little bit and things like that. But it was absolute chaos. And I think I only got through that period because I kind of had two brains, where I had a work brain that was focused on doing this job, and then the other brain that was focused on like the real world. But the real world one was pretty fuzzy most of that first year, I think. So I don't know. It was a bit of a different experience, I think, actually, for me versus for these guys in that first window.
Yeah. So just to back out for a second, it's clear that this project became, from a few people, to like a real university-wide kind of effort. And I know the Applied Physics Lab came in to provide some stability to the architecture, and obviously the communications team. Marianne was really involved. I guess, how does this, do you all have a sense of how this fits into the university's sort of history as the first research university and the foremost research university? Did it feel like this was sort of like a Hopkins, you know, point of pride or point, you know, of future?
I honestly believe it wouldn't have happened without Ron Daniels. I think he immediately saw what Lauren was doing, saw that the work was incredibly valuable, resourced it out of his own budget to start. You know, we never had to like ask really for resources in those first few years. Like, it was taken care of. Now, we did some fundraising for it, but the university was, you know, obviously like deeply supportive and basically said like, go do. Like, there wasn't anything that we asked for that we didn't get in the first run of this work. And then he forced me, and I mean, I can't tell you, like, Lauren's probably one of my closest friends in Baltimore. And that's, you know, with respect to this like total innate desire to have interdisciplinary work come to life in the institution. Like, I would have never been able to crack that door open in systems without a moment like this. And now it's nourishing a whole field of study around how data can interact with the way that we think about cities. And I think a lot of it is because of the vantage of the institution and their desire, not just to have deeply impactful research, but for that research to be purposefully cross-cutting and for it to be bringing expertise from across the institution and to force joint appointments and to think about our work with interdisciplinary values at the core. And that doesn't happen without a lot of structure, a lot of intention, and a lot, honestly, of norm breaking for higher education. And so I do think that the institution, it wasn't just Lauren and me and Marianne and Lainey, who was, you know, really integral at the beginning as well. It was also like everyone in the institution. And then, like, as time went on, we had faculty from all corners of the institution, like, coming forward and be like, how can we help? Like, this is a transformational moment for the institution. I'm thinking about this data in this way. We're looking at, you know, we had business school faculty talking about how this data has impacted their analysis on how goods and services move throughout the world. We had public health, obviously, deeply involved, but we also had, like, Dr. Garibaldi, who was running the biocontainment unit and was like the medical leadership for the country around how to treat patients, coming in and sitting with us and talking about the data and using it and helping us and refining it. We had engineers lining up. We had social scientists lining up. You know, every aspect of life was impacted, and every you know, sort of area across the institution also kind of mobilized. And it was, for us, you know, it really showed a new way, a different way that the academy can show up in the face of a crisis like this. And I hope that we are continuing that in that tradition, even outside of the presence of the crisis, but to solve some of the world's most intractable problems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just would add, I 100% agree that the work would never have grown to the scale and impact that it did without Ron and without Hopkins, no question. I think, you know, we started it because we were thinking about our small little research community of infectious disease modelers would use it. And in the end, I think the most rewarding and like most revelational piece of this was the demand for this information from just the general public alone. And then in between there is all of the public health, you know, practitioners and policymakers and decision makers who really should be relying on this kind of information for driving decisions. But Hopkins was just absolutely primed to play the role that it did in hosting this, providing this, sharing this, translating this information, right, in context with the relevant experts, because of its, one, its kind of global reputation in public health and medicine, and then it's kind of trust as an academic institution in this time period where misinformation was becoming rampant, and, you know, especially around the virus and around public health. And so I think that it was just an absolute perfect setting for hosting this kind of information for the world, and has brought to light a lot of really important questions when it comes to how to share information and facts and translate science, and like, who should be responsible for these kind of things, and what role should institutions and academic institutions play versus governments when you're talking about sharing information that's become highly politicized, that shouldn't, you know, but that shouldn't be. And so there's just so many bigger questions and roles that have come out of this that Hopkins is central to now and that academic institutes in general are actually, I think, looked to now that weren't a question before, outside of even any of these applications that we're talking about. So it's been a really interesting and I think enlightening time for how the world learns about things.
Yeah. And I think talking about the public health a value of the CRC and of an institution like Hopkins, I wonder how things pivoted when, like, late in 2020, you know, the first vaccines were approved and the CRC began to track vaccine data, which I know presented its own host of challenges. Maybe Mary or Sarah can talk a little bit about how, first of all, from a sort of a logistical standpoint, I know it was quite a challenge to track all the states in there. I heard there was, you know, holidays canceled, that kind of thing. So what was it like to sort of try to integrate that data and provide another service?
Well, I can speak a bit to the start and then Sarah, I'll hand it off to you. But the reality is that the dashboards that were producing this information more locally, because the federal data sets lagged behind the state, which lagged behind the counties. And the dashboards that were presenting vaccine data as it started to come online, there's no sort of automatic feed of those things. So it involved manually checking to see when the data started to be presented on these dashboards and then determining the best way of acquiring the information. But at the outset, because things were coming online at different times, it was just a strictly manual effort. The vaccination data started to become available in December of 2020, early December of 2020. And Sarah led our team of researchers in doing the manual review and collecting the data, very much like what Lauren described Frank doing initially, collecting it into spreadsheets and figuring out the best way of creating a routine out of the update. So Sarah, do you want to talk a little bit about the holiday schedule that year?
Yeah, like, honestly, we knew that the vaccines were coming, and it was in November 2020. And I think at that point, the whole team was praying for the vaccines to come sooner, but especially before Christmas, so we could have everything figured out before going on a break. And that happened. We started collecting data early December. And yeah, exactly like that, we put together a spreadsheet. So every single day we had a routine and we divided the states. We were collecting data at the state level because it's impossible to go manually at the county level. So we basically divided. You will get those states and somebody else will get those. And myself, like all of us, we roll up our sleeves and starting like tracking every single day all the webs to look for the data to appear. And then once it was appearing, to start collecting the data and then figuring out like the whole thing. It was not like cases, which is like you get a case or you don't get one. It was, what kind of vaccine are you getting? Is this a two dose? If so, you know, how do we track first dose versus like second dose? Like how long do you have to wait between them? You know, is this shot the first one or the second one? So all these questions came up, which complicated things a bit more than for what we had so far, which were cases and deaths. So that happened. And hopefully by the time Christmas arrived, we had the structure in place and then we divided the days. I still remember on Christmas Day at 9 p.m. connecting and going through all the states so that nobody else on the team had to do it that day. So that was Christmas 2020.
Wow. I wonder, you know, it's interesting to talk to the four of you, the four women here today who were really leading this work. And we talked about people like Marianne and others at the university, Lainey, who, was there a moment where you all realized, wait, it's really notable that there's all these women who
yeah,
are
I mean,
leading
I
this
think
work.
Early on, we were like, this is incredible to have this. We had a leadership team meeting that included the four of us. We had Lainey, who was there representing President Daniels. We had Marianne, who was representing all the communication strategy. And then we also had Jennifer, who was an epidemiologist. And that was kind of the core working group for a very long time. We ended up getting Bill as our vaccinologist, and he threw the whole thing off. And then Brian was also our medical expert. So we did have
and
some,
Tamara.
Yeah, and then Tamara from APL. That's right. Absolutely. Who also had a baby during this. We had lots of babies, too. I think we birthed like three babies during COVID on the core team. So you know, I definitely remarked on it frequently. And if you look at a lot of the press coverage that the team got, you know, there was a feature in Nature magazine, Time magazine, New York Times, Washington Post. It is remarkable, and it was remarked on, that we were a team of women. And I think I certainly wouldn't have it any other way. I think the reason that we created something that was trusted, very detail-oriented, impactful, I don't think it's disconnected from the fact that we are women. Many people may disagree, but in my core, I believe that it wouldn't have happened if the circumstances were different.
And free.
And free. Well, that's the big piece. Like Lauren, so Lauren and I started a routine of walks. I think it was several days a week at least that we would go for a walk.
That was how we did our meetings.
That's how we would do our meetings. I would bring vegetables from my garden. I became a gardener during this period of time to like offset. And then also I think I had like a one of those like farm box delivery things.
Well, I couldn't sit in all of the structured meetings that Beth was in because I was doing all the data stuff. So I would do all that. And then Beth and I would meet and she would fill me in on all the critical things from all the other meetings she sat in. And then she would basically help me play telephone to back to the rest of the.
And I would bring you vegetables and fruits. Don't forget that.
I've done it. And cookies.
And cookies. Lots of cookies. But on these walks, very early on, both Lauren and I had been approached by like pretty big technology companies that wanted us to essentially give them over the data operations and they would assume and own the data so they could commoditize it. And, you know, and maybe improve it, maybe make it. There were probably good and bad aspects of why a big platform would want to be the owner of this data. And we sort of worked actually with Christy Weiskel, another woman on campus. We had some conversations with Christy, but Lauren was very clear that she did not want there to be any barriers to getting access to the data. And I very quickly agreed because this is, you know, when we start to see efforts like this create pretty significant disparities in health outcomes. And that was obviously for me, something I did not want to see and wanted to make sure that anyone who wanted trusted, open information about what was happening in this chaotic crisis could get it without ever having to deal with a paywall, with accessibility issues. And so it wasn't a very popular decision because there were important stakeholders that wanted, you know, to be the owner of the data. But it was the decision that we made and we stuck with. And I think a lot, I look at a lot of my colleagues in this field that are not women who made a lot of money during COVID, being experts, being that kind of translational asset to the private sector, to the anchor people on the news every night. And that certainly wasn't what we were being motivated by.
Yeah, and I know that the lessons of all of that work have continued. Can we talk a little bit about what you all learned from being part of this project for so long? And I know it's inspired some of the projects that GovX and others have coming up.
Yeah, I can just say one of the things to me that was the biggest takeaway was the translational aspect of this data for the general public. And obviously, like I said, all the decision makers that you would expect to want to have this, but we, like I said, we started this thinking about a research community. We ended it thinking about providing this service and a satisfying a need for everyone. And so that learning has impacted the way I do research in general, because this, I mean, another thing to highlight is I actually am not a data collector. That's not my job. My job is actually a data user in mathematical modeling to help guide these, build these decision support tools. And I think something that I didn't value as much until this process was the role of the translational science and the communication of science. I always knew it was important, but I don't think I actually understood the complexity of it. And I think I spent more than half of my time after, at least after the first 2 months, on communicating what we were doing to everyone, internally and externally, as much as actually doing the data collection, because it was so important to be transparent. And that's part of writing journal papers, even. It's just the communication of this process and being as transparent as possible. And now in building, collecting data and building data-driven tools, I'm so much more focused on the utility of these things, the translation of these, the use cases. And sometimes that means not always advancing the science as much, but making sure that it has more impact. And so there's a little bit of a scale where I think you have to kind of weight these things. But I think that's just, it's really altered a lot of the philosophies behind my lab and in the way that we conduct research now, and kind of reverse engineering a lot of it, focusing first on these needs in the world and who's making the decisions and what kind of capabilities do they have, and figuring out then how do we build tools to meet those needs rather than coming from the front end, which is here's some data we have and let's build a tool and then let's see if someone wants it.
And Sarah or Mary, can either of you talk about how this work I know inspired some of the city level data work that we're looking at now?
Yeah, so I think one of the most important lessons that we learned as a team was that not only the general public, but also local governments are eager to have data to make decisions. I think, you know, we had been working for so many years on that, at least from our perspective of the, you know, data science analyst kind of things. But I think COVID was the moment when it became very obvious. And, you know, from news outlets showing data and numbers and data visualizations constantly every day to the public consuming this data and local governments standing up dashboards, that was something that many local governments never had done before. And there you go, suddenly everybody was building a dashboard for COVID. So I think that showed us in a very direct way how much need there was for data that was properly translated and ready to be used. So after that, we decided to expand and focus on building a similar tool that provided such accessibility and data that was clean and ready to use, but expanded to any topic related to quality of life and standards of living in cities. And this is what we are currently working on and hope to release a tool very soon about it for the US. I would say on a personal level, I still have the voice of Marianne in the back of my head every time that I try to build a data visualization, saying that anything that is not time on the x-axis is going to be complicated to understand. So what we learn a lot is, you know, we have always built data visualizations, but for a community that was very limited for data people, it was never for general public. So we learned a ton from the communications team, and we benefited from this multidisciplinary team in learning how we should communicate data with the general public. And that shows up every single day after that.
Piggybacking on that, also the contextualization of the data, because you can have an easily understood visualization, but unless you have a mechanism to talk about the nuances of the sources and the caveats and where you needed to make your best estimate, where it's not necessarily exactly a lot of the sources, you know, you can't say that this number is correct all the time because they review records, they change data and things like that. And so trying to capture all of those different pieces of information that will help someone understand the full scope of what it is that they're looking at is really important. Whether or not people always read it, who can say? But you need to be able to provide it to have that sort of transparency available to the consumer.
That's great. Thank you. We're getting close to the end of our time here. I want to mention, you know, I mentioned at the top, this is Women's History Month. And I wondered if each of you could just take a minute to talk about the path that led you to your career in data, and if there were barriers along the way, if there were inspirations, just sort of what's your path? Could I start with you, Beth?
Yeah, sure. I had a very, well, my degree is actually in women's studies. I have a mathematics background, but also my degree from the University of Maryland is in women's studies. And I think one of the skills that I learned when I was in school in the women's studies department at the University of Maryland is critical thinking. And just really being able to understand that the experience of all people isn't the same, even when we live in a homogenized society, that we have so much sort of baked in bias and we have so much baked in assumptions around the experience of life. And so I came out of that work. I worked in government for more than a decade, where I brought those skills first as a juvenile probation officer and then sort of as the chief operating officer of the state. But then even more so here, where we are confronted with big, hard challenges that we're all trying to navigate in our daily lives, but also as mayors and as city leaders and as government leaders. And oftentimes we don't stop to ask the hard questions about why, how we got here and do the kind of systems reengineering work that's required to actually fix entrenched problems. And so I think that that's something that I got out of, you know, someone who's deeply focused on gender and gender identity in my education, because we're constantly in the field being asked, hey, like, how did we get here? Why do these disparities exist? You know, and that those types of questions are something I can bring into the work, whether that's if I'm addressing who has access to healthcare, how come, you know, one of the things that I'm most proud of in this work was that we started really observing that we weren't collecting race data as a society in this country. And we knew anecdotally that Black and Brown people were being disproportionately affected by the pandemic. So we created a map that just showed, like, in very clear terms, that we're not collecting the data. So we can't show you the racial breakdown because that data doesn't exist. And here are the one state or the two states that do it. And then the power of our prominence in collecting this data, within 2 weeks, the tide had turned on how many states started sharing demographic data about COVID. A lot of that is rooted in this innate positioning. So I was deeply informed in this work by the work I did as a women's studies scholar, for sure.
That's great. Thank you. Mary, you want to go next?
Well, I guess if we're going to go back to college, I have an English degree, which makes no sense at all in the line of work that I'm currently involved in, except it does speak to the communications aspect and being able to take complicated topics and distill them into headlines and the most important pieces of information to learn. But I went to a Jesuit institution whose whole ethos is men and women for others. So it was really important to me to seek work that was mission driven. So that is where I found myself working in the nonprofit sector. Previously worked for an educational nonprofit called the Success for All Foundation, working with a program called the Center for Data Driven Reform in Education. And public health data is messy. So is education data. So that was where I cut my teeth on that sort of realization that trying to fuse together an aggregated product is impossible when you have states that report data in different ways, focusing on different arenas, different demographic readouts and things like that. So it was good that I had that experience previously, because that played into understanding why it was so complicated to pull together data in a meaningful way that was accessible to the general public.
Great. Sarah, would you like to go next?
I don't think I had like any particular woman that inspired me, but I come from a big family. I have another 4 brothers and sisters. 3 of them are sisters. The oldest one is a medical doctor, and then I have a naval engineer and an architect. So there was never a question whether a woman can do anything in my family, and I happen to be curious. So I think that's really all you need to get in the data world, like to have no question that you can actually do it. And that was definitely the environment that I grew up in.
Amazing. Dr. Gardner?
Yeah, I'm always a bad person with these questions around why you ended up in the position you're in, because I think I do think it's of interest to note that none of us are public health trained. So I actually have all engineering degrees myself. And just, I think a combination, kind of like Sarah said, of opportunity, preparation, and curiosity. And I just have a very selfish, windy path through life that is driven by, I think, trying to always do well at what I'm currently doing and building out skill sets that are pretty, you know, analytical, and then applying them to things that come my way that I'm interested in and think are important. And this was just a perfect opportunity.
Great. Well, thank you so much. And thank all of you for all the work you have done and continue to do, and for being guests today. This has been a really incredibly informative conversation. And I thank all of our listeners for joining us today. If you'd like to learn more about GovX, you can find us at govx.jhu.edu. And please make sure to fill out our listener survey and subscribe on your podcast app of choice. Thanks for listening.